women in space, and meal planning for space travel. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Christina Koch became the first woman to venture to the moon last month during the Artemis II mission. It marks another step forward in equality and inclusion for space travel and follows in the footsteps of other women, like Eileen Collins. She was the first woman to pilot a space shuttle and command a space shuttle mission. We'll speak with her about Koch's milestone moment and look back at her career. Then, as we look to the future of space exploration, space travelers are going to need something very important, like good food. One chef and professor is making and eating food designed for space travel. We'll speak with University of Central Florida's Cesar Rivero Cruzado about some of the space food he and his students are making. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Last month, Christina Koch became the first woman to travel to the moon. She holds other superlatives, too, like participating in the first all-female spacewalk. Koch's role in the Artemis II mission follows in the footsteps of other women participating in space exploration firsts, like Eileen Collins. She was the first woman to pilot a space shuttle, and then became the first female commander of a space shuttle mission. Her story is chronicled in her memoir, Through the Glass Ceiling to the Stars, and she joins us now to reflect on Koch's giant leap in inclusion for human spaceflight. Eileen, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to talking about all things space.
Yes, all things space, and it truly is an incredible time when it comes to space news. Eileen, we're just a few weeks after the safe return of the Artemis II astronauts. I just want to grab, you know, as a former space shuttle pilot and commander, reflect on this moment. What kind of moment in history was Artemis II?
Well, first of all, I want to say I am extremely happy with the way the mission worked out. Of course, I know that these missions are risky. This was not really the first time that this hardware and software has flown, but it is the first time with people on board. So I watched the mission very carefully. I know they had a couple glitches here and there, but overall, it was extremely successful. I am so happy to see that all of these years of work have come together and people can really celebrate. You know, we're looking at the heat shield. That was kind of one of the major objectives of the mission is to see if that heat shield was going to come back intact. And everything we've seen so far is that, you know, it performed very well. And two things overall, did the life support systems work? Keep the astronauts, you know, alive as far as their things like the carbon dioxide and the water and the oxygen? And then how did the systems perform on Orion? And I think that we're still waiting to get more details back, but I think everything performed really well. So people can be happy. I'm happy with the decisions that have been made to add Artemis 3 as a low Earth orbit rendezvous and docking with the two landers. I think that's very important part of bringing the risk down for the overall program. And that Artemis 4 right now is planned to be the first moon landing. Congratulations to the astronauts and congratulations really to the whole team. I mean, everything from management to the engineers, to the people working in mission control, the flight controllers, the flight directors. I hope they're having some great splashdown parties. Keep them coming.
I'm sure they are. And keep them coming. They should. As you alluded to in that response, Eileen, you know, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman, he added the Artemis 3 mission to increase the cadence of these missions. So you come from the space shuttle program where that flight cadence was very high. Is there something that can be gained from having a high flight cadence outside of just mitigating risk?
Yeah, I think one of the complaints that I do have on the overall Artemis program is it has been taking so long. You might remember that Artemis 1 flew at the end of 2022. I mean, that's just too long between missions. And some of it has to do with the money. Some of it has to do with, you know, the fact that it's a government program. NASA owns and manages the Artemis program, whereas these commercial companies like SpaceX and the others, Boeing launched the Starliner, SpaceX launches the Falcon 9 and the Dragon, they are flying more routinely. And you've really got to keep flying more routinely, not only to be safer, to bring the cost down and get that scale of, you know, maybe to speak in economic terms. And if you're going to fly Artemis every 2 or 3 years, it just doesn't make sense. So I do agree with picking up the pace, but keep in mind the fact that the Artemis program, the Space Launch System with the Orion capsule on the top, that is a government-owned and operated program. And because of that, NASA cannot raise money like these private companies can. So All of the money that NASA is getting comes from Congress. And Congress, as you know, can be fickle. They can like take money away one year and put it back in the next year. And if you can't plan out, you know, for example, private companies can raise money. They have investors. You know, they can, you know, obviously go public, or they can raise their own private capital. That is the way we need to be doing the space program in the long run, is having private industry, having commercial companies doing it, because then you can get the economics down, you can get the scale, you can get customers, you can get investors. And I think in the long run, right now, deep space is pretty much the community of government right now. You know, you've got, obviously, China's going out there and Russia wants to go out there. But in the long run, it will be commercial companies that are leaving low Earth orbit and going to the moon and eventually someday going to Mars. And, you know, we're taking baby steps. And one more important thing I want to say about that is the government goes first. I say government, meaning NASA, goes first to show private industry it can be done. We can maybe bring down the risk by sending these government missions out there. And private industry says, this can be done. We understand the risk better. Maybe we can make a profit out of it. And so I think we'll eventually see, and I predict in my lifetime, we will see people flying to the moon on vacation, I will say. Like today, you can go on a cruise ship and cruise around, you know, the Atlantic or the Pacific or the Mediterranean Sea. Someday people will be cruising to the moon, and we would never get there if we didn't have private industry doing that and knowing they can make a profit out of it.
What an awesome future that sounds like. I'm going to be saving my money and make sure my passport's renewed so I can go and do that one of these days.
It'll be some risk takers going out there the first couple times.
Yeah, I'll go. Maybe I'll let a few go before I can sign up for that. Eileen, let's talk a little bit more about risk. You mentioned this earlier. One of the things that was you know, that we were keeping a close eye on with the Artemis II mission was that heat shield. As someone who's flown as many space shuttle missions as you have, you know that re-entry is a very dynamic and very risky portion of the flight. Were you holding your breath waiting for them to come out of that loss of signal and see that they made it through okay? Walk me through it as somebody who has experience like you, what that moment was like.
We knew we were going to have that loss of signal that was planned. And I don't think there was any more loss of signal than what they actually knew was going to happen. NASA adjusted the trajectory of the entry to really prevent this heat buildup, followed by a cool down, followed by another heat up, because they think that maybe there were some trapped gases on Artemis 1 that caused those pieces of the heat shield to pop off. I'm not a heat shield expert, so I'm not going to try to go in any deeper than that. But I do know that the commander, Reid Wiseman, along with his crew, looked at the changes that were made to the trajectory. They listened to the engineers. They understood what the risk was. They accepted that plan, and they felt confident enough about it to put their lives on that Orion capsule. And obviously, they came back fine. Honestly, I was not as worried as some people were. I really think that this particular issue had so much scrutiny placed on it for so many years. And even though we don't have a lot of data, like really to make a good decision, you have to have a lot of data, a lot of experience. We didn't really have that with the Orion capsule. So that was really the residual risk that was left over was, you know, we need to get more time. Of course, to get more time on the Orion capsule is extremely expensive to actually, if you want to send a bunch of them out there and bring them back and see the performance over and over again, that would be ideal, but we can't really afford that. So NASA does a lot more by analysis. But I think the fact that the crew was willing to accept that spoke volumes.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eileen Collins, former space shuttle pilot and commander. She's also the author of the book, Through the Glass Ceiling, Through the Stars. Eileen, as part of your storied NASA career, you were the first female commander and pilot of a space shuttle mission. And on this Artemis II mission, we had another first for women. We had Christina Koch, who became the first woman to travel to the moon. Tell me a bit about what that moment means for diversity and equality when it comes to space travel.
Yeah, well, back in the early days, as you know, there were no women that were in the astronaut program. It wasn't until 1978 that NASA hired their first women astronauts. And those were the six women that came in the very first class of space shuttle astronauts. And that was a big cultural change for NASA. In addition to the women coming in the military as pilots, which is what I did before I came to NASA, that was a big cultural change to have women flying military aircraft. And I think that now all these decades have gone by, women are just part of the mission. I think from Christina's point of view and probably the other women in the astronaut office, they're like, yeah, hey, we're just part of the mission. You know, we don't really want to stand out as, oh, you're so different because you're a woman. I think we just want to be good contributing crew members. I also, having said that, I want to congratulate Christina 100 times over. I'm really proud of her. She has done great for the reputation of women, I think not just in the astronaut program, but overall. If you might remember, her and Jessica Meir were the first two women to do a spacewalk where you had two women on the spacewalk. And, you know, that was, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but that was a big deal at the time. And now we have two women go out on spacewalks and nobody really talks about it anymore because it's kind of just part of the mission, as I said. So I congratulate Christina and all the women who are in the astronaut program right now. I'm not sure I'd want to be one of them right now because I believe that any day now they will announce the crews of Artemis 3 and possibly Artemis 4. Whoever the first woman is to walk on the moon, her life will be forever changed. And I look at how my life was changed being the first woman pilot and commander of a space shuttle. And I think it's going to be peanuts compared to the first woman that walked on the moon. That's going to be a very big deal. So I think all of the women in the astronaut office right now could do that. I'm not sure how NASA is going to do the selection process, but I'm really looking forward to seeing who that's going to be. It probably won't be Christina. I'm sure she would love to go back and walk on the moon, but I think they're probably going to try to spread the wealth a little bit. And Christina is going to be very busy doing all of her post-flight work.
You mentioned something that your life changed because of that superlative. And this next one, the first woman to walk on the moon, will be a massive accomplishment. And their life will change, as you say. What advice are you giving to that woman?
The first thing, by far, be the best you could possibly be, which involves knowing everything about your spacecraft, knowing everything that could fail on it. What actions do you take if you do see a malfunction, a failure, an emergency? Be the best you can be. When I was flying the shuttle, I always thought, well, if something goes wrong, I want to be the hero. So I think you really just being the best you can possibly be. Now, when the mission is over, that is a huge, from a human point of view, that is a huge change that a human being goes through. Buzz Aldrin wrote a book called Return to Earth after he came back from the moon, the kind of changes that he had to go through. Neil Armstrong did not write a book about it, but I know that he ended up just wanting a normal life. He did not want to be out there having, you know, I mean, honestly, when I came back from space on my first mission, people would take my hand and they'd be shaking. Oh, can I touch you? You've been to space. And, you know, I wasn't quite ready for that type of reaction. I think the key thing is to maintain humility. There's so much advice. You asked me to give advice. There's so much I could give. So I'm just trying to like hit the high points. It is so important as a human being to maintain your humility. And I actually pray for humility. I just want to be a normal person. I just want to live my life every day. You can't come back from a mission like the first woman on the moon and go take a job somewhere in that NASA management that someone else could do, that a commercial company management job that someone else could do, because there'll be a huge demand on your time for speaking, for, you know, writing your memoirs, for, you know, maybe make a film about your life like I ended up doing.
That was former NASA astronaut Eileen Collins, the first woman to pilot the space shuttle and later the first female commander of the space shuttle mission. Her memoir is Through the Glass Ceiling to the Stars. Still to come, baking dishes designed for space.
The advantage of freeze-dry is that you preserve flavor, aromas, texture better than dehydrate. Dehydrate, you need to apply heat, so change texture, change some of the flavors.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. For over four decades, the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation has given out scholarships to students in support of STEM education, including Artemis II astronaut Christina Cook. With over 55 university partners, the organization hopes to help people reach for the stars. We'll talk more about the foundation on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about food in space. As humans explore space like never before, commercial space travel is on the rise. And one day, the goal is to have regular people living and working in orbit. But in space, neighborhoods, or vacation ships, they'll need something very important. Food. And more specifically, good food. That's where one professor at the University of Central Florida's Rosen College of Hospitality Management comes in. Our producer, Marion Summerall, spoke with Cesar Rivero Cruzado, the director of food and beverage operations at Rosen College, and part of the Faculty of Food and Lodging, about some of the freeze-dried food he's making with his students and why. Here's that conversation now. Our producer, Marion Summerall, spoke with Cesar Rivero Cruzado, the director of food and beverage operations at Rosen College, and he's part of the Faculty of Food and Lodging, about some of the freeze-dried food he's making with his students and why. Here's that conversation now.
Cesar, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for being here. We're talking about something really exciting, which is food in space.
I'm working in Rosen College, the hospitality college from UCF. And we start, you know, all this change and interest in space, the space revolution. And we start talking about space tourism and space hospitality. And inside the space hospitality, everybody needs to eat, right? And that's the part of space food projects that we're working. And we just giving the students the opportunity to see and experiment how food could be produced in space with different angles, not just only tailored for astronauts and scientists that will be in the space flying, but also for tourists and the layman, the regular people that are going to space and work in space.
When we think about food in space, right, you think about dehydrated food. This is talking about actual cuisine, not just if we're on the International Space Station, but if we were to be regular people, were to be living and working in space, or dare I say, even on the moon or Mars.
So our approach is just explore what we have, right? You mentioned freeze-dry. Freeze-dry is very important for many reasons. And it's one of the components and the techniques that we use and we experiment right now. But also we're trying to see in the future and in the long run trips. Because freeze-dry will work because things are on a short trip, because you can bring those from the Earth, but you know, bringing things from Earth tend to be expensive. And in a long trip in the moon, it's not going to be feasible. What we're exploring now is developing closed-loop food systems that mean that we can produce the food in space, right? We're exploring different crops and implementing different techniques that allow to expand and make the experience more enjoyable.
Tell me about some of the food that you are working on in this pilot program.
Everything born from SSEP Vision 21. It's a competition that the UCF participated last year, and it's like a student space program, and they do an experiment, and whoever wins, they will have the chance to have that experiment conducted in the ISS. It was great. It was awesome. Rosen College, for first time in history, participate. We didn't win. It was a great opportunity for our students. Keep in mind, we are social studies. That's social science. Sorry, that's our field. We are not hard science. But our students managed to come out with four different projects and proposals for developing food in space. And from that competition and that effort, it's everything born and developed. You asking one of the food that we try and experiment a lot. It's a coagulation of vegetable proteins. And put it in an easy way, it will be trying to make tofu in microgravity. So that's the part, that's one of the, actually one of the experiment that we submit. And it was to check in and see the coagulation of the vegetable proteins, in this case, the proteins in the soy milk, to make tofu. Tofu is a really simple product, high in protein, high in density, and also it's very easy to make. We only need like 3 or 4 ingredients. The idea to keep working with tofu and working some with different options is soybeans is something that you can grow in space. So that's part of it. So of the projects that we were last, we're experimenting with freeze dry. So we see freeze-dried tofu, freeze-dried vegetables, and then trying to make a dish from it, right? Something that will be appealing for the regular people, not from the astronauts, right? And we make the spicy curry tofu, one of the things our students were experiment with. There's different approach, right? At least the approach for us in Rosen College, we see the food production from, and this is my coin, I put it from a hedonistic perspective, right? We want to enjoy the food because it's one of the very important part. You have food scientists that are really good taking care of the nutrition and the nutrients in the food, right? They know about that. But in our case, our expertise and what we can bring is the enjoyable part.
I just want to make sure I have that right. So what you and your students are doing, so you're actually taking like freeze-dried tofu and then you are crafting dishes from that.
Exactly. Yes. In our facilities, we have a freeze dryer machine. So one of the experiments, one of the things we're running, we get a recipe, regular recipe for a tofu curry, and we collect the ingredients, mean vegetables, the coconut milk and everything, and we freeze dry those. So we remove the moisture of it. The advantage of freeze dry is that you preserve flavor, aromas, texture better than dehydrate. Dehydrate, you need to apply heat, so change texture, change some of the flavors. But with freeze dry, so we're experimenting now with collecting ingredients, combine them in a Mylar bag, and then add water to it, mimicking the same experience the astronauts are having now in the ISS to see how the product come out, to see if it's good and see if the texture change and if it's appealing. And that's one of the last thing we did.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. You're hearing a conversation between our producer, Marian Summerall, and Cesar Rivero Cruzada, the director of food and beverage operations at Rosen College and part of the Faculty of Food and Lodging, about space food. Here's more of that conversation now.
You don't really hear about this often, right? You don't hear about students and a professor creating, I'm going to call it space cuisine. Did you see yourself being in this kind of pilot program in this project with these students, like maybe a few years ago? I mean, how does this feel to kind of be working on things that have the potential to be used later down the road in space by not only astronauts, but potentially when we do start having hospitality and tourism in space?
No, never. For me, I wasn't that aware of the space and space exploration and all that. But the last, I'd say, probably 6-7 months, thank you for the initiative from my chair, Dr. Amy Gregory, and she's in charge of the every related to space and space hospitality. And between me and her, started learning, get involved, and she asked me if we can do something in the lab. And we start experimenting and creating a cohort of students and some staff working also with us. And that way we start doing this, and it's been great.
Could this one day, I know right now it's a pilot program and you've been working closely with a few students, but could this one day be a course, right, that students could actually sign up for and register for and like be in a huge classroom doing this?
That could be an option. Yeah, because what we try, and actually this is a practical part, right? We go into the lab, we practice what we learn, the techniques, and we apply. But the other part, the lecture part, right? It's a subject that they learn. What we're trying with this pilot is around 2 weeks in the course. It's just to make the students aware of another possibility. This is a few billion dollar economy and enterprise. There's a lot of opportunities. It's not like years ago, right? You don't see, it was only us scientists, engineers, and now the space economy is open to everybody. So even chef can work with that, you know? So that's what we're trying to get our students open their eyes and see, hey, this is another possibility.
And okay, I have to ask, what are some of the favorite dishes? So you said that you and your students can sample these. So what are some of the favorites? What's some of the feedback we're hearing?
Obviously, when we're talking about the dishes, most of the work that we're doing is being with the tofu, being difficult because I'm not a big fan of tofu. But we found that that was really, really easy to make, and it was very high in protein. So it was very the ideal candidate for that. But we now have seen how versatile it is, right? We can freeze dry, so we rehydrate and make cooking in different ways. But always the favorites are the fruits, because we freeze dry bananas, freeze dry mangoes. One of the other recipe that we make, it was a sticky rice pudding with mango. So with the mango, freeze dry mango is always a plus because it's sweet. So you don't need to add a lot of sugar to the product, but that's one of the favorites.
I also wanted to ask, what are some of the challenges here? We're talking about rehydrating foods and, you know, space is an environment where, depending on where you are, you have to be really careful of some things.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot of challenges in space, especially for us as a culinarians, for us as a chef. And I always make the same example. It's like chopping onions. For me, it's something so simple. You can chop onions and the onions will stay in the cutting board. In the case of space, everything will float. And when we design the food that we're going to eat, we need to take care of a few considerations. Crumbs, it's one of them, right? Little particles that will be floating and could be dangerous, right? Not only for the physical health, could get in your eyes, but also will damage equipment. And those little things that you never think in a kitchen environment, now you need to be aware of that when you work in space and taking in consideration the recipe that you're going to make, right? You don't want a lot of particles. We're working with a trail mix. It's a certain trail mix that we're using for one of the marketing purposes, but also we developed the recipe with some of the students. The idea is to use this in space. And one of the considerations that we need to take is the crumbs. So we always are working on that and see if start as a trail mix, but then we find out there had a lot of particles. So we need to combine it. So things that we always need to keep in mind.
Cesar, I want to wrap this up with, you know, we talked about how exciting this is to potentially be, you know, take this as a course and take this a step further as we kind of grow and get towards that step of having more people in space as an educator, right? How does that also feel to potentially be helping these students find maybe another career path?
The most rewarding, it's been rewarding this last 6 months, being crazy ups and down, going to every place, learning a lot at the same time with the students. But it's very rewarding seeing their potential, see how they open their eyes and they see that hospitality permeate in everything. Everything is hospitality. This industry that for most of us is just far away, it's just only for scientists and engineers, now it's open for them. And see the students develop and see the student talking about that, it's amazing. And we have actually an interview last week and see one of my students develop and talking about the project and how she owned what she was doing. It was amazing and very rewarding.
Cesar, thank you so much for joining Are We There Yet to talk about some of the space cuisine you and some students are working on over at Rosen. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
That was Are We There Yet's Marion Summerall speaking with Cesar Rivera Cruzado, the Director of Food and Beverage Operations at the University of Central Florida's Rosen College of Hospitality Management. He's also part of the Faculty of Food and Lodging. They were talking about space food. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.